Hi, I'm Tracy Madigan. Welcome to a special episode of Francophiles. We're changing our format today to zoom out. Usually, we talk about the links between the U.S. and France. With the war in Ukraine, we wanted to look at just one of the factors in the international efforts to calm that conflict: trade. Ambassador Philippe Etienne often gathers experts here in the U.S. to converse and offer varied perspectives on big issues. He keeps his finger on the pulse of the American viewpoints. He did that recently here in D.C. on the topic of trade. The international guest, Cecilia Malmström. She's a former member of the European Commission and the European Parliament. She served as European Commissioner for Trade from 2014 to 2019. Malmström represented the European Union in the World Trade Organization and other international trade bodies. We wanted a primer on trade during wartime, its power and its politics. Our goal is to engage and be enlightened on parts of this conflict that the international community can do something about. Malmström spells out the history, the tactics, and the mindset on trade during wartime. Here's our conversation. Thank you for joining us on Francophiles. You are an expert when it comes to the conversation in all its aspects on trade. And so I want to talk a little bit about, first of all, your past when it comes to, because you were joking saying all your titles have former in front of them. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory professionally as it relates to trade.
Well, I have been in the European institutions for a very long time, as a member of the European Parliament, as a member of the Swedish government responsible for EU issues, and twice a commissioner. And the second time I was commissioner for trade, meaning that on behalf of all the EU member states, 27, I negotiated trade agreements, I represented the EU in WTO, and I was responsible for trade-related matters for 5 years in Brussels.
In that experience, what do you commonly see is a misconception when it comes to the importance of trade and the realities of trade?
Well, I think that most people, they don't really think about trade in their daily lives. They have their iPhones, they have their jeans, they have their things that are imported and sometimes composed of, you know, hundreds of different items from 50 countries, but they don't reflect much about that. And that's in a way a good thing, because they can buy things, there's a lot of supplies, and there's a lot of choices. But we as policymakers need to explain that trade is actually a good thing for the world. It brings innovation, it brings jobs and investment and growth, and it enables us to exchange ideas with other people as well. So it's more about, it's not just figures, it's also about creating partnerships. And maybe politicians around the world have not been so good at explaining this to people.
Why is that?
Well, I made it my mission during my time as commissioner to really try to engage, because in the beginning of my mandate, there were lots of protests on the street for a negotiation we made between the EU and the US, something we called TTIP at the time, a trade agreement. And that came just after the economic crisis. So I think many people were suspicious vis-a-vis big companies and banks and insurance companies and feeling that ordinary people suffered a lot, but the governments were more focusing on bailing out the big companies. So, countries and politicians and companies didn't really speak out in favor of trade at that moment. So there was a missed opportunity to engage with the public.
So let's tell some war stories when it comes to that. When it comes to that agreement, you were on the front lines. President Trump was in power here in the United States.
Well, it actually began during Obama. We negotiated this, and we it went rather well, but it wasn't a done deal. And then, of course, when there was a change of president, it was sort of put in the freezer. But there were difficulties also under the Obama administration, because, of course, both the EU and US are big economic powers. We are used to get it our way, so compromising was not easy.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about that. What are the intricacies behind the scenes of when power changes and deals die?
Well, as I said, it was difficult already from the beginning. Not everything, because there was also an agreement that this is a good thing, because EU and US, we trade for millions of dollars every day. But we could take away some administration, we could make it easier and cheaper, and that was the intention. But, you know, we both have important agriculture industries that are subsidized. That was tricky, and we set standards in different ways. And not necessarily one way is better than the other, but you mean that you need to harmonize the way, or you need to recognize each other's systems. And that's quite hard. And when President Trump came, of course, he said that, you know, trade deals are not good. They are bad if they're not only good for me. Trade wars are good, easy to win. So there wasn't really an interest in finalizing or even continuing those negotiations. They were more focused on imposing tariffs and so on. So that was a bad moment in our trade relations.
So when you are dealing with someone who actually enjoys being at war rather than solving problems, rather than signing, that makes your job more difficult.
Yes, we did have a few items around which we cooperated under the Trump administration. We tried to see if we could recognize some standards to facilitate trade, not that we have to double test things and so on. And we worked on investment screening, and we tried to do a few reforms together with Japan in WTO. And that, you know, that was rather successful, but that was, you know, tiny bits of a broader cooperation.
Tell us a little bit about Buy American and the pride that Americans have when it comes to their products, their, you know, what they're producing, what they're buying, etc. And then marry that with foreign policy in general. So when it comes to trade, how are those three? You got trade, you've got Buy American, and you've got the trying to marry the two, the diplomacy of trying to marry the two.
Well, that's when it becomes tricky. It is perfectly normal that Americans are proud of what they produce, what they sell, goods or services. Like we in Europe, we are very proud of some, you know, iconic trademarks from France and Italy, and some food from Greece and so on. So that's not the problem. The problem is if you promote your own products or services at the expense of others to make it difficult to import these things. Buy America forces products to be made in America with American components, and that makes it very difficult for Europe to compete if you want to do that. So there's a sort of inbuilt discrimination in that, which is problematic from a European point of view. It is not problematic in itself that the Americans are proud of their products, of course, but if they discriminate vis-a-vis others, that's when it becomes tricky.
And foreign policy plus trade equals what?
Well, trade ideally is an important part of foreign policy, because foreign policy is about negotiations, it's about diplomacy, it's about influence, it's about power. And well used, trade can be a very important part of that, because you create alliances, you build bridges, you unite also people, and you get to know each other. But trade can also be a weapon. And we saw the weaponization of trade becoming more frequent during the Trump era, where he imposed tariffs, taxes on products like steel and aluminium towards Europe and others, and saying that this was for national security reasons, which is, of course, a strange argument from our point of view. And that's when it becomes difficult, and saying that trade wars are good, because trade wars are never good. Because they create conflicts. And who suffers? Well, products become more expensive, there's less supply, there's less innovation, and it's the consumers who pay higher prices.
So along comes President Biden, and everyone said, President Biden doesn't like trade wars. President Biden will save some of the deals that were on life support because of the notions that President Trump had. And yet, how much change actually happened when the White House was handed over?
Well, in practice, not much changed, actually. There was a totally different rhetoric, and there is a true will to really reach out to Europe and cooperate and you know, deepen the transatlantic link. But I think this administration is not very fond of trade deals, and they are more into protecting American workers, which is again, perfectly fine. But when that comes to the expense that you're cutting yourself out trade-wise with the rest of the world, it becomes problematic. So in that regard, the policy have not changed too much, actually.
Do you think that's one of the things that people understand less, that they believe that a change did happen with the new administration, but in fact, if you really look at the numbers, not much has changed?
If your leaders, independently who, and you have elected them, and they keep telling you that trade is not good, and trade is taking away your jobs, and trade is creating a competition that is unhealthy, of course, people will believe that. And they see that the local factory closes down or moves abroad, which is always a tragedy. But that's usually not because of trade. It's because, you know, robotization, automatization, or the competition was just not sustainable for that particular product or that particular industry. So blaming trade for that is not correct. And cutting yourself out from trading in the world, you know, the US is a big market in itself, but you still need other components and you still need to buy things. And now it has become more expensive. And it is the ordinary person who pays for that.
By definition, trade is a form of having a border eliminated because there's a free flow of goods. Mm-hmm. And yet when COVID hit, the borders between so many countries became more evident. What did that mean for someone like you who deals in trade and tries to make those borders disappear for fluid reasons, to have them all so evident again?
Well, COVID is, of course, you know, a unique event. And actually, trade worked rather well during this period. I mean, there were food in our stores. We had commodities and it did flow. But it created a lot of hiccups. People started to buy a lot of things online, which created combustion in the ports. And we still are suffering from that because there are not enough ships. There are not enough transport. There are not enough people to handle this. People were sick. They were isolated or in lockdown and so on. So that we still live with that despite of COVID being phased out. But I think that is recovering more and more now. So it's a new kind of trade. So of course, those who deal with this need to adopt. We have seen, at least in Europe, I haven't seen the figures from US, that digital trade has gone down quite dramatically. People want to go out and shop and, you know, touch the things. Is that a trend or is it just temporary? It's hard to say, but still the products need to come in the shops.
And ultimately, again, someone in your position who lives and breathes trade, the fact that the borders became more visible was a reality, but also the process, the supply chain. I mean, everybody knows what supply chain means now, and not a lot of Americans knew before what the term supply chain meant. So
exactly.
We saw how the sausage is made.
And it became very visible with the blockade of the Ever Given ship in the Suez Channel. This
Remember
had
that?
Nothing to do with COVID, but it showed that when one ship is blocked with thousands of containers, the effect of that ship being in Egypt meant that there were no bicycles in Sweden, or that there were no garment leaving for Turkey because they were stuck in this, or there were also live animals on board who unfortunately did not make it. And that, of course, affected what was in the shops. And I think that particular accident, which was a tragedy and costed a lot of money, made people realize that, wow, we are really dependent on the transports and the supply chains flowing.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't realize where this stuff was coming from until they saw the traffic jam.
Indeed.
And that was one incident. But then they see it in the ports in the United States and elsewhere, where all those things are backed up. Speaking of the fact that now the public is more aware of trade and the existence of it, we got to know more about supply chain, chips. Mm-hmm. Again, there's so many things that as consumers, we start to appreciate more. That's become part of our common knowledge now that we know we can't buy a new car, perhaps, because they need the chips. Let's talk a little bit about the politics and what becomes visible. When it comes to Russia and the Ukraine, what Russia was exporting before the world turns its eyes on it, and what the pressure is for people like yourself who are experts in trade, what are we looking at as far as what Russia had been doing, what can be cut off as far as its profits and what makes its economy roll, and how should we be looking at it?
Well, first of all, this is a terrible and totally illegitimate war against an independent sovereign state being invaded and attacked in this brutal way. So this is against all international laws. And the effect has been that most of the world have united around massive sanctions with a goal to isolate Russia politically, culturally, scientifically, but overall economically, to try to sort of make their economy fall apart. Whether that will succeed or not is too early to say, but of course Russia and Russian normal citizens are suffering because there are no goods in their shops. Lots of multinational companies have left. McDonald's have closed, Starbucks have closed, IKEA has closed, and all that. But Russia is also a very important producer of wheat, and that is something that is exported to the world. And also Ukraine is. And this is the period when you sow and yes, you start preparing. And when there's a war in Ukraine, you can't do that. And Russia is blocked from the international markets. And a country like Egypt is totally dependent on imports of wheat for bread. And we risk to see hunger, famine in some countries in the Middle East and in Northern Africa right now. And that is of course, going to create a lot of turbulence. And similarly with the energy prices, they were high already before the crisis, but they are even higher now because especially Europe, but also other countries import oil and gas from Russia. Some of that has stopped now as well. So it will trigger a lot of turbulence on the markets. And it will be felt for ordinary citizens because you have to pay your electricity bill and you have to eat bread. So this is very tangible what it means. It's not something, you know, up there. This is every day.
People know it because they're putting it in their cars, right? They're indeed putting it in their gas tanks. Give us a snapshot of the decisions that had to be made in Europe as far as continuing to receive gas and oil from Russia during this time. To what degree was Europe's hands tied on deals that had already been signed and the process that was already underway? And what control did they have to curb that a bit?
Some countries are very dependent on gas. Not all, but some are. Germany, for instance. And 40% of all the gas imported to Europe comes from Russia. Now, Germany has a contract, and other countries are affected as well, with Russia. One was Nord Stream 1, and another one was just supposed to be set in motion, Nord Stream 2. So the Germans have cancelled the licenses for Nord Stream 2, which is an important stroke for them and for the Russian economy. And some countries have actually cut down on their imports from Russia as well. But some countries, Germany, Bulgaria, the Netherlands, Italy, are very dependent on this. So this is the only area that still is not subject to sanctions. It's controversial, this of course, because it means that Russia gets a lot of money that can finance the war. But on the other hand, if you stopped that would have tremendous effect on the German and Italian economy and on the consumers and on the industry. So as for now, they have not been ready to do that. The US have put sanctions, but the dependency is very, very little in the US. It's a much easier decision to take. It's a tough decision to take. It might reach that stage if the war continues and gets even worse, if it can get worse. But that is the one area that is so far excluded from the sanctions.
I don't want to ask you to make a prediction, but what are the possibilities for weaning off, so slowly reducing the amount of dependency there?
That's being planned because, of course, you need to move towards fossil free energy anyway, and that's the plan. This is going to speed up that. So the Commission are preparing and proposing ways to reduce and to cooperate and to find other importers and other sources. But this is not something you change overnight. I mean, this is complex infrastructure that is not there. We are buying more liquid gas from the US, for instance, and seeking other partners, Norwegian gas, some from Kazakhstan and Algeria, and so, but it will not be enough to fully cover if you cut off Russia. But of course, we are moving towards spring, and if the brutal killing of innocent civilians continues, maybe this is going to happen. But for the moment, the German government have been very clear it's not going to happen.
So let's talk about spring, because we touched on wheat before. If the oil continues to flow across the Russian border out of Russia, but the wheat doesn't, that's not a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign, and that will not affect Europe so much, but it will affect a lot of developing countries who are already affected by COVID, by the international economic downturn, by inflation, by high energy prices. So, of course, we risk to see. So we need to make sure that those countries who have that possibility to have the crops and who can expand maybe quickly, that we all need to work together globally to avoid famines.
Is that happening?
There are lots of discussions on it. G7 had a meeting. They discussed this and they agreed to put up some action plan on it. And there are lots of different initiatives. So yes, it's definitely on the agenda. But exactly how it's going to be done, I don't know at this stage.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, because this is a podcast based in the United States for people who have an interest in France, and I have the expert here on trade, I wanted to get your opinion from your vantage point. How is trade seen in Europe, and how does that differ, in your opinion, from how Americans see trade in general? Obviously, we can't generalize with such huge populations, but the openness, the understanding, the will to make deals, how does that differ in Europe versus in the United States?
Well, trade has become politically sensitive in Europe as well. But of course, the very fact that we have a common market and that the European countries have traded without borders, without any rules between them, has contributed so much to our welfare. And that is known. People recognize this. Then some countries, like the country I come from, Sweden, is totally dependent on trade. So that's not really a political issue. Everybody knows that millions of jobs would be lost, millions really, if we were not trading. In other countries, maybe they are dependent on trade, but it's not that important part of the economy. So it's, but there's a feeling in Europe among citizens, which I think is a global trend, that trade is fine, but it needs to be fair. There needs to be, you need to know that my suit has been produced under decent conditions, that there are no child labor involved, that the environmental footprint is okay, etc. And the Commission, and together with the European member countries, have been working a lot on this to make sure that there's a level playing field, that trade is done in a fair way, and that you can be sure that international conventions are respected as much as possible. Now, this is hard to follow, of course, and to implement, but lots of steps have been taken in that direction. I think that is a key to reach people's heart, mm-hmm. as well, that they know that this is produced in a fair way, and that the companies are making their part for sustainable trading.
You're here in the United States more often now. You're with the Peterson Institute. Yes. And so on a daily basis, what things come up when you're here in the United States talking about trade and all the other things you specialize in versus when you were back in Europe? What are some things that you find yourself having to repeat or explain that
well,
you hadn't heard
at
before?
Peterson, of course, everybody are promoters of free trade. But I think the US role here is very much discussed, because all over the world there are trade agreements being made. And there is this huge trade agreement that was made in order to isolate China in a way, what is now called CPTPP, with 12 countries in North America, South America, and in Asia. And the US chose to withdraw from that, whereas more and more countries are applying to join. So is the US going to be isolated on this when other countries trade under favorable conditions, which is it's not... They will have privileges that American companies do not have, or market access that American companies do not have. So that is, of course, a discussion that is very much here. There is now the United Kingdom, Taiwan, and even China have sought to enter into this CPTPP. And other agreements are ongoing. Also, lots of things are happening in Africa and so on. So there is a discussion that I hear that where is the US? I mean, the US should take leadership and should be there to also frame the rules. But I don't really hear that. I hear more that, yes, we want to cooperate with the world, but not on trade.
So as we end our conversation, you've impressed us. I believe that one of the hardest parts about your job is probably trying to remember all those acronyms.
Exactly. And I get it wrong sometimes. There are too many acronyms.
And you've also given us something to look forward to when it comes to figuring out what role trade is going to play in the months and years ahead. Mm-hmm. So thank you for giving us that look into the future as a signal of whether trade is becoming smoother or stickier given wars, pandemics, and other things that the world is facing. So thank you so much for the time that you spent speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show and who you'd like to hear us talk to. And please subscribe and rate this podcast. That way, more people will hear about it. Our podcast is produced by me, Tracy Madigan. Our editorial team is Pascal Confavreux, Baudouin Carrard, Pierre Léonard, and Susanna Autier. Our technical team is Nasrin Mirza and Patrick Nazaire. Thank you for listening. Au revoir.